Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
the Stardust Periodic Table. With all things, I'm sort of struggling to understand things. I'll go into that a little bit later, but I'm podcasting, and with the permission of, generous permission of various magazines, been able to podcast them freely from cover to cover, which is good. And I've come up in the summer 2018 Cosmos magazine on page 111. There's a article, and it's cover. This is the popular magazine Science Club, When Stars Collide. On page 111, there's a Stardust Periodic Table, and there was sort of just areas which I just couldn't make it out. It was hard to understand. So I'll just have to rewind a little bit, sort of, why am I podcasting, why am I studying and stuff like that. So, I am, or have been, a quantum physicist. Or working in schools with various sort of heart's disease and, which is okay. A lot of people have them. And a lot of the great things is that you get fixed up. There's also the cognitive stuff of, your sort of memory going. It's hard to describe it. In fact, you can't describe it. At each point in time, you don't think necessarily there's something wrong, but you've got a feeling, nagging feeling. And so you have to go through the process of getting your skills up again, podcasting skills up again, but also the memory skills and hunting around, you know, things don't quite, you construct together, and because you've got previous knowledge, it doesn't quite go. So is there an error? Sometimes there's an error in what you've taught for years, and so I'm sort of grateful to go back and find errors. The famous, or the most infamous one for me, is the Stern Galactic experiment with a beam of what I thought were the electrons. It was neutral silver. And then when you're going in, it's sort of just not good enough to just do a cursory remembering. You have to sort of remember to a deep level, or study to a deep level, such that the memories that you did have gel together, because they're all sort of scrambled. So as people have listened to me, and this is probably quite an insight for people who want to listen, I struggled through the periodic table, sort of reading a general book, then going back again on various things and getting through it. And sort of you find out that yeah, indeed, when you really look at it, there are mistakes embedded in what you've in what you're studying. Just the nature, there's mistakes embedded in what you've previously learnt, and there's sort of mistakes embedded in the systems of society, or people working together, sort of alike of mistakes which have sort of become built into the way we do things. And you can't be too high-minded about it. The mistakes are mistakes. You've got to understand them, appreciate them, talk about with people with things, but just move on and keep the pace going. So I came across this periodic table, and it had dying low-mass stars, merging neutron stars, which is great, exploding massive stars, exploding white dwarfs, Big Bang, cosmic ray fission. Sort of a colouring of the periodic table in different colours, such that you can see the origin of different elements. And I've been looking at the periodic table for a while and spotting a few elements which, say, various organisations have put in the wrong place, or it's a human story, and there's mistakes. So, like, arsenic is named masculine, but it's a mistaken hearing of someone another language where the word arsenic comes across. And there's a few examples of that. Like, platinum is the Spanish for gold. Wolfram, there's various ones, like tungsten means heavy rock. It's all various things coming across. But to try and define about, you know, are there errors in the periodic table, or do people use a periodic table within a cultural sort of boundary marks, and it's the right periodic table for the purposes. And I think that that might be it in this case, they've sort of defined the boundary markers, but they haven't actually really sat back and explained what's going on. And there's this sort of naive view, but the understanding that periodic tables are used by different groups for different purposes, and they can use it, but without being too aware of the purposes going forward. And therein lies something that there's sort of this higher level of description of the periodic table, where you could say things which are universally true are not frame dependent, so to speak. And they're not said because of, I don't know, this cultural thing. So what I'd like to do is sort of, before I get into some commentary on it, go into some sort of basic rules you could have about the periodic table or observations. One is that for any element, if it's got an even Z number, it's more stable and more abundant. And so, comparatively so, it's more abundant. There you go. One of the things is that people believe that hydrogen, because there's 75% hydrogen and roughly 23% or more helium, hydrogen is the most abundant element, but it's not the most abundant by mass, because helium is four times greater. So you've got three hydrogens and one helium, roughly speaking, but the one helium weighs four and the hydrogens weighs three. So the majority of mass in the universe is helium. That's one of the things to get out. But anything with an even Z number, particularly you can see it really strongly in the transition elements, has a greater abundance. So this is one of the first things to say. Probably the second thing to say is that the way the periodic table is displayed is a mashup, a printer's mashup, and that is the F block is put down amongst the is put down in a separable subtable, and the reason it moves is there's actually no reason for it. It's just a cultural reason. It's a reason we print because of the size of paper, the way the orientation of books we produce. It's a cultural artifact. It's got no reason in science that there should be the place down there. So that's the abundance ripple in the periodic table, the actual shape of the periodic table. General observation that people can know quite easily that the periodic table is broken up into blocks. The as you read across, the S, D, P, and F block for sharp, principal, diffuse, and fine lines. So it's sort of a historic sort of artifact getting in there, but they're broken into blocks. And again, you could say, oh, look, it's quantum mechanics, I don't really want to know it too much. And there is a lot of quantum mechanics in the periodic table. But the important thing is to realize that although there are trends, there's more significant similarities between the blocks as sub-blocks. So a trend across a block is repeated again across block after block. There's the various trends you get across. So zinc, cadmium, and mercury are really the noble gases of the D block, and the P block has a non-metallic end and a metallicity increases as you go across it. So it's sort of and there's a whole heap of features, and if you go into electron affinity, which is a critical thing that people tend to leave out of the periodic table, because they leave it out of science, and they're sort of like teaching a half science. So what I'm saying is that there is these insights into the periodic table which offend no one and expands people's viewpoint, because they're not getting into the view of it. Now, I should say why do I look at things this deeply? Sort of, it's almost two reasons for this. Is before I get into sort of the middle point of it, and then the sort of deeper discussion of the periodic table right event. One is a quantum physicist, so I've had to sort of step outside the world of common agreed social knowledge, and with supercomputers calculate small molecules, and so that's you sort of realize, but it's a very private realization of an errors of mistakes as you advance your understanding. So necessarily advancing your understanding is realizing that things are wrong in the wrong previously. So there's that mode, and as I discussed, it's this trying to navigate your earlier advanced understanding with your current level of what's things going on. So you can say something. If you say something, this is incorrect, and people around are convinced that it is correct, the natural human response is to say, well, you don't know what you're speaking at, and you push away. And you sort of know that and accept it, but it doesn't change the fact that what you say is correct. It's just what you need is a bigger understanding of the greater, broader range of facts and greater, broader range of things around the social periodic table, the social mechanism of what's going on, the flows and structures. So, the important thing to say is that the periodic table is true is for different situations. So, if I have a periodic table on Mars is different from the periodic table on Earth. Yes, the elements are the same, but the concentrations and the amounts of each element are different. So if I pick up a Martian rock, as my friends do in Antarctica, if I go with their motorized skis, see a meteor in the snow, sticks out like anything because it's black, and it doesn't melt into the snow because meteors tend to be cold, remarkably, when they hit the Earth, because they're out there generally a few degrees Kelvin, if you're lucky, above the background temperature. So the universe is around 2 degrees Kelvin-ish. And so they pick it up, put it in their mass spectrometer, and it will tell them immediately, this is from Mars, this is from Venus, this is a meteor from deep space. So the actual composition of elements really is the composition of elements when that rock condensed and came across. So much so that the periodic table in Australia is a bit different from the periodic table from Chile, for instance. So rocks in Australia will have a slightly different elemental a mass compared to Chile. So Chile, particularly Chile and lithium, is a different isotopic mix. So what that means is when you look at those numbers of atomic masses, when I say take 602 billion trillion atoms, of chlorine, that will be weigh 35.5 grams. That's a very simple sort of thing. And this theorem goes, the study that if you study it enough, you can actually see linkages, sort of direct paths for it. So, what people have is a sort of mountain range that they take people through of different concepts. Really, this is a direct path. That 602 billion trillion is Avogadro's number, and 602 billion, it seems so easy to say, 602 billion trillion of this atom will give you that atomic mass, that mass, relative atomic mass, RAM there, which is an isotopic mix. And as there's different processes going on, you get different atomic mixes. Now, when you really push this, you get these strange things happening as you go into a small scale. Obviously, human periodic table is different. In a human, your abundance of elements in you is totally different from your environment. The crust rocks are different from the moon rocks. The crust rocks are different from the deep mantle rocks. You know, they're all different as you as you go into the rams. I had an important point to say there. So to understand this, you understand that there is no single periodic table. The periodic table really requires a little person to come out the front and explain where it's from. Now, this particular periodic table is, as it says, a stardust periodic table. So it's the elements are all churning around, and at the point in time does the actual it says at the point in time where you pick up some stardust, what's in that stardust, where does the various elements come from, there's certain sort of parts of logic here. And one of the things that you really have to explain is that the elements go around and around and around. So there's this theory that the elements are made bang. Or no, what in actual fact happens is that there's this process and elements gets recycled. So it's sort of a bit like having a fairly good, robust, so own lawnmower and selling it on Gumtree or eBay, or you don't think you have a charity, you have charity shops where you have quite good goods and it just goes around and recycles in the community. So there's certain things that recycle, and there's certain elements which are in the recycle trade only. And this periodic table here is the periodic table of when it's all dispersed, everything's cooked in the ingredient, and it's now out at the county fair or sort of at your primary school election with sausage shills. The birthday cakes is out there. They're the cakes on sale. They're the cakes on store. So in the universe store, that's a one way of seeing it. Now, in that as much, we have a certain amount of things that a bit of head scratches. Okay, so 25, you know, the vast majority of helium has been produced in the nuclear synthesis of the Big Bang. But you're saying here, it says here helium is produced from the Big Bang, from massive stars, and a little bit from low mass dying stars. A bit of a head scratcher, because they're not made there. They originate the helium. Perhaps the helium. Oh, it's sort of really hard. Because look, I have something, a piece of evidence here. It's just popping its radiant signs through the gum trees up here and putting the early rays, and that's the sun, called Helus, where we've discovered this element being produced in abundance in the helium. And of course that helium has been made by not low mass dying stars, it's been made by sort of middle life fairly minor stars coming across. So that's in there. Now again, I suppose the next probably element to comment about is lithium. Now there are certain elements which, so there's a cycle, the view of a cycle, and this is not, well, it's got difficulty representing a cycle. You can have a periodic table which represents the elements found in mid-cycle. You just have to explain that or show a series of periodic tables in three-dimensional space, you know, mid-cycle, Big Bang, and that type of stuff. And again, this is perhaps here. Now, lithium, beryllium, boron, all very important in the production of fusion energy. So fusion is where the hydrogens get converted into a neutron, and that's a critical thing. So you have to produce the fundamental thing to build heavier elements. You have to convert. There's two steps to build a heavy element. There's one is that you've got to convert a proton into a neutron, and then build the neutrons into a bigger nucleus, and then build a bigger nucleus. So the first step is you've got to make neutrons. Now, in that fiery process, lithium, beryllium, and boron get burnt up. So in general, as they're really burnt up in stars, they've disappeared. So these stars, besides producing matters, are hoovering up these elements and destroying them. And so they only get remade as sort of a cosmic ray afterthought. Except obviously for here, lithium. So they have found that lithium is not destroyed efficiently. That might be a better way of saying it, in low mass stars. Now, low mass stars, I think, is looking at the diagrams. They're referring to dying stars as the asymptotic giant branch, the AGB, and that's from 0 to 10. 10 solar masses, and low mass in that, what they mean by low mass there is from 8 solar masses down to 0.6 solar masses. And that has a process in it. And we'll have to describe it more. Now, as I said before, there's some mistakes I've had, and there's mistakes in here, social mistakes. And so here, I wouldn't call it a social mistake, it's just people are not very careful with their periodic table. They don't understand that it's it's like a language group, it's an ethnic group. It's a periodic table that a group of people use. What I'm trying to say is that there's also other mistakes deep embedded in things, and the problem is that you're not this high-handed person going, oh, there's a mistake, oh, I'm going to write to the editor of the Times about this. No, it's just, gosh, I can't understand that. That doesn't fit together. Something's wrong with my understanding. You go back and forth. And so we're going to stop here a little bit. And discuss fusion, because fusion is the stuff in stars, which and in the Big Bang, which puts lighter elements together from the top of the periodic table down to the base. And we're going to discuss a little mistake. Now, the sort of fundamental thing of making a neutron is that you can ram two protons together. And those two protons, if they're pushed together enough and they've repelled enough, the weak nuclear force can go in, and a neutron can be formed. As a bit of the kinetic energy goes, a neutron is formed, and a positron and a neutrino, real matter neutrino, is produced. That makes deuterium, and so that's the fundamental thing. A positron is produced, deuterium's made, and then helium-3 is made. And the P1 process is... So there's three proton processes to go through, P1, P2, P3. And the P1 process is the major process in our star. That's just two helium-3s get made, and they get slammed together. Now, there's the P2 process, which again I looked at, and I'm just trying to remember. And this is in, again, looking at Wikipedia, what a great resource. Looking at the P, so the P one process is two positron production of helium, because you've got to remove two positive charges, because helium's got four nucleons but only two positive charges. Those two positive charges go as positrons, and they go off and annihilate the electron, producing sufficient energy in that process. The P2 process involves, well, I think lithium or beryllium or something like that, and lithium. So you make some lithium by slamming helium-3 and helium-4 together. Does that make lithium? Does it? I think that would make beryllium. Oh, yes, it probably does make beryllium, something like that. But then, the next, so you get a positron being produced to make helium-3, helium-4 has been made earlier, so that just comes in, that's just No worries, that's there. And then you make beryllium, and beryllium has got too many protons, and so it undergoes electron capture. So an electron gets slammed into the nucleus, which is pretty actually easy to do. And that makes lithium, and then the lithium, must capture a another proton, and then that produces. But if you look in detail at the Wikipedia diagram, they're missing an electron, the electron capture. If you look at the diagram there, I'll publish it there, I'll put up the diagram, missing electron capture. So it's not that there's one person's made one major mistake. There's these little minor mistakes in there. Then you've got the helium-3. P3 thing, and I just have to remember that's also a double positron production. I just can't remember how the positrons are produced there. So that's an important thing. And then we get the next cycle, the as the stars pick up. So we've got a very low mass of stars. No neutrons are being produced here. Our star is not producing heavier elements, and it will eventually when it goes into helium burning. It's got a combination of helium burning and something called the CNO cycle. Now, the CNO cycle, people are sort of saying, oh, the God particle. There was an early 1950s God particle, and that was carbon. Carbon was the God particle. Because before the CNO cycle, we have the triple alpha cycle. That's four heliums put together form a carbon nucleus. Now, what this is that you can form beryllium, and beryllium doesn't last very long in a star before it's used up. But before the beryllium goes, another helium slams into it and it makes a carbon. But there's a little bit of a story to it in terms of it doesn't make a carbon, it makes a resonantly makes an excited carbon, which before it can fall apart, radiates out radiation and decays to a ground state, a nucleus. And so the production of carbon by triple alpha requires the intervention of God, so to speak, to produce a, I'm going across rather well, 27 minutes, to produce carbon-12. So there's carbon-12 star, and that star radiates quicker than it can decay. So it radiates back to down to a stable state quicker than it decays. So triple alpha is that stars can produce carbon-12, which happens to be the explanation of how come there's so much carbon. We've got the triple alpha thing. And I think about 1% of the energy. So if you get your solar cells, and you're making $100 from you're making $100 from your solar cell, $99 comes from that from the P1 process. Almost done comes from the P2, P3, and none comes from the triple carbon, but some comes from the CNO cycle. And the triple carbon gives you the C to start the CNO cycle. And it's not that, and so our stars are 1% there, so slightly larger stars at 10%, 30%, and before very long, the CNO cycle, so it's carbon, nitrogen, oxygen cycle. But it's nitrogen as we know it, but not oxygen as we know it in the cycle. So these stars are producing it. Now, one of the things is that this periodic table tells you as it's produced. As I'm saying, there's a lot of elements in play being plundered all the time. So it's sort of like saying what's produced out of a car factory. Well, I'm putting in all these light bulbs, all these bits, all these substructures, and a car rolls out. And you can say, well, yes, there exists car seats and sub-assemblies. But they're only in the factory, so to speak. So they're there. So they're in factory. So there's a lot of in-factory CNO. So what happens is carbon, is there a nitrogen, or CNO? Yeah, so the a proton goes into it, a proton goes into the nitrogen then decays back to carbon-13, carbon-13 gets another proton, that goes to a nitrogen, and then it goes to another proton. You get two alpha particles out, positrons out in the process. It goes to carbon, nitrogen, and then the nitrogen's now got sufficient neutrons in it now to go to oxygen-15. The oxygen-15 is about to go again, and basically a helium peels off. So you put in various four protons in the process of this cycle. You never make oxygen-16, which is the critical thing that we're all breathing. Obviously, you've got oxygen-15. So this CNO cycle, a little bit of oxygen in the process in that star, gets used up in the process. It only lasts a few seconds. So the CNO cycle doesn't mean that you've actually got oxygen or the nitrogen being produced in the cycle. So we've got this CNO cycle. What they say is that it doesn't produce oxygen-16 because it doesn't have the resonance to produce it. And so there's this, oh my God, God has intervened and actually made a resonance in carbon just enough to make triple alpha, which allows the CNO cycle, but it hasn't allowed all that carbon to be used up, making oxygen. Of course, that happens a little bit later. So that's the overall cycle. So you've got this happening in stars. Now, eventually, these stars burn up their hydrogen and collapse, become hotter, and start to produce more aggressive cycles. And that's where you start to get this dying low-mass star. When they mean low-mass, they mean 0.6 to 8 solar masses. So that's... we're supposed to have a medium mass star or a dwarf star. At any rate, and this process means that if you remember the CNO cycle, the first process was nitrogen, and then nitrogen goes, nitrogen 13 goes to carbon 13. And then what you can do is you can slam the carbon-13 with helium particles rather than a hydrogen, because the hydrogen's run out, the helium's hit it, and this produces a neutron, lots and lots of neutrons. And so in these stars, as they're in the process of burning up heliums, they start producing free neutrons. So one of the things which ain't existing in our star, or any healthy star, is neutrons. So these neutrons produce a flux, and what happens is that this is a moderate flux of neutrons, and this produces the S process for slow, and that's, for me, in cardiac rehab, can't you just call it the slow process? Why do you have to codify it calling it the S process, but slow, the S process, and this S process then activates. Now, it normally wouldn't do anything except when the star has inside it iron from a previous supernova. So this is complex. This is rings within rings of processes within processes. And here's a simple, kiddies, here's a simple periodic table at the end of it. Carbon-13 gets a helium slammed into it. A neutron gets chucked out of it, and this then fires in and produces, activates iron, which is number 6 across, so it's in group 8. It's in the middle of the periodic table. The iron's there, stable, fossilized metal from earlier supernovas, so this is second generation. And this neutron flux just means that any element just gets tickled up the periodic table, and it goes up, it decays a little bit back, and essentially if there's any root of just sort of like rolling, it's like rolling a ball up a hill into pits, and you can roll it, just walk up once a day, once a fortnight, just gradually roll it up over a period of time. This is a slow process, and indeed, this starts to produce, this slow process produces elements within the range of S, after strontium and barium, which I sort of now rememberize. After that, it starts to tickle the elements up to produce it. And so there you do have a low mass star. It's really asymptotic giant branch star. And the thing is, how do people see the elements in these stars? And because we can't see a lot of the helium in our star, because the helium in our star is in the core. It sort of sinks to the core, so you don't see it. But there is this beautiful thing called churn, so asymptotic giant branch stars have an unstable core, and every once in a while it just goes into convulsion, almost supernovas, but it pulses, and when it pulses it stirs itself up, and so it stirs its core into its outer shell, and asks astronomers to see what's in its core from the outside. And finally, when these blow, they produce a fraction of their elements are left, and there from that the mid process S process, high neutron flux. And then that's the main process. There's the main and also a weak process, which occurs in 8 to 10 solar mass stars. I've read this, and I'm just data dumping it just to get it out of my head. And they're produced through a similar process, not with carbon 13, but with a neon process. So these are getting pretty serious. Neon produces another flux, and that produces a second population of elements there. Now, what it sort of means is that it's sort of like if I pick up a rock, I could say, well, this rock has had this history. It's been produced by this star. It's like picking up a rock now and saying, well, it's come from Chile. Don't give me rubbish. That garden rock there, you've dumped at me from Chile, because I can do my spectrum analysis. You can do a similar thing on stardust. You can say it's come from this and that. And so you've got the higher mass range, which is the weak S process, and that's with Dion, and that tends to produce elements from downwards between iron and strontium. So there we go. Strontium. Oh. That's an interesting thing. I'll just have to get in my head and just slowly learn things. So then you've got the slow process, you've got the rapid process in a supernova. So you don't get any S process stuff unless it's been distributed by a supernova. So you can't just get pure S process low elements. You've got a combination of the exploding massive stars, and the exploding massive stars produce all the elements down from rubidium, or really from zirconium downwards. They can't produce it. So the rapid process is you've got a million times more neutrons just streaming through the place, and so what happens is that you produce these elements, and it's like putting it on the factory floor. You've got a production line on your factory's floor. Now, what happens is that, say, you have a stage and it comes along here and you're a slow worker, and by the time you get across, the entire thing is falling apart. So you're dressing a store mannequin with, a store mannequin's come across and you're trying to put makeup on, and shirts and stuff like that on, and it's not bolted together well, and it all falls apart. And if you're a slow person, what happens is it falls apart before you can ever do anything. If you come around with these really speedy workers, they can put it together and get it all dressed and zipped up before it falls apart. And that's how you make the other elements, that they tend to fall apart. Or the other thing is that they tend to, you know, my overall view is, you know, I'd really love to know, I do think it has to go making these other elements, further up the periodic table badly, and they fall apart to form your lower elements. I think that would be something which I would find a bit more credible, credible for production. But these people have gone through with all the postage stamp. I knew people who were doing the cross sections and just going through and doing the postage stamp work. They call it postage stamp work, collecting stamp, working out the different cross sections and calculating what can go through. So that's your various things. Then when you're in that subsection, of supernovas, so you've got type 1 to type 2 and type 1A, B, C, D. Type 1A is a particular supernova where you get around the fact that a star stops itself supernovaing because it's got a process of radiation and heat which stops gravitational collapse. But if you've got a gravitational collapsed star which is not really radiating, and this is really interesting, 4Y neutron stars don't radiate. One aspect is that they've got a very small surface area, but they've also got no necessarily the degenerate electrons. The electrons aren't in a process that can actually radiate. They just can't radiate. That's why they're hot. They stay hot because they've got the energy in there, but the energy can't radiate. It's the electrons aren't free, so they can't radiate. It's part of electron degeneration. If you get rid of your electrons, you get rid of your ability to radiate. So that means that you can basically feed a neutron star, sort of like that. It's like that Monty Python scale where one move wafer, surely we'd like one more wafer, and then vomiting everything like that. That's a type 1A supernova, and you get obviously a selection of there, which is from exploding white dwarfs. So white dwarfs don't normally explode unless someone is naughty to them and feeds them one more wafer. And of course, the great thing of this article is it's going along up to my cardiac rehab. Sorry, chaps, at Cosmos, I've got to reach a certain podcast length to go through, and this is a hard thing. I'm aware that, as I said this, my memory has failed me on various points in time. You may not be aware of it, but I am. And then you've got the mystery solved from the neutron stars. But the other interesting thing is that the neutron stars produce something, but it's not the only source of gold. If you actually look at it, a tiny fraction of gold is from the asymptotic main branch, this slow neutron production. It's nothing special, it's just that you've only got selected varieties of paths which you can add a neutron to from. If you keep on adding a neutron and it all falls apart, you go back to square one. So different paths, getting to gold path can be quite tricky. So really the kilonova is sort of fills the periodic table. It's pretty much the same way the down from the way that a supernova fills it down. So you've got these two processes of nucleogenesis. And I suppose the important thing is that this is really a stardust. If I pick up a meteor up in space, that's, you know, and I suppose we are stardust. You have that really songify or songster thing of we're stardust with that various American astronomers are talking about. So that's the periodic table getting across. So I suppose if I had to say, it's not criticisms, but say that the periodic table is a periodic table of end of process At the end of the day, what comes out of the factory, but inside the factory there's a lot more complicated cycles and cycles within cycles going on, and a lot more history and interest going in. Dying low mass stars would be asymptotic main branch between 0.6 and 8 solar masses. Exploding white dwarfs would be type 1A supernovas, just to get that over. Exploding massive stars would say supernova. They just go like that. And to go across, and I perhaps would say technetium is actually produced by stars. We can observe it in stars. This is, technetium's, made in asymptotic, giant branch stars, which you observe, which are going through churn, so it makes some technetium inside, and it's actually produced up. But it's missing in the stardust, so it's pretty much how you'd say it. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.